Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I'm Shane Bacon. Hopefully, the socks are dry after an incredibly wet week there in New Orleans. Golf was postponed and postponed and postponed and postponed, eventually leading to a unlikely winner, which brings us to our first segment called Just a Reminder. There's a lot of really good golfers out there. Brian Stewart, your latest example of this, a winner at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans. The depth of golf right now, I don't think people totally understand it, especially with the way some of these names dominate the headlines. But Stewart's win, you know, you look at the list of guys that have won this year. Jim Herman's another guy, completely out of nowhere, comes out and beats very elite fields with very good players. I mean, Jason Day trying to win that event, obviously goes into playoff. Jamie Lovemark, a very, very good young player who a lot of people are just waiting to see get his first PGA Tour win. And old Brian Stewart just does his business and gets a first ever PGA Tour win. Had never won on the web.com. How did he do it is the question. And the answer, he went 44 of 44 from putts inside of 10 feet. Let me say that again. Inside of 10 feet. You guys know what 10 feet looks like. It's the putts that we rarely make as amateurs. He didn't miss all week in New Orleans. 44 of 44. It's insane. I mean, that is such a crazy stat to see. The guy obviously can roll the rock, and that's what he leans on. But, you know, he got it around, hit some great shots down the stretch, hit a great shot on 18 in regulation, hit a great shot in the playoff. But again, golf is so deep right now. I was ridiculed by some radio people when I said I thought there were 60 players in the Masters field that could win the Masters. And honestly, I might have been a little low. I mean, you're talking about Rory McIlroy, Ricky Fowler, Henrik Stenson, Dustin Johnson, Justin Rose. These are top 10 players that haven't won on the PGA Tour this year. You know, meanwhile, like I said, Jim Herman and Stewart, Charlie Hoffman, these guys are winning. At any given week, anybody can win. I mean, and that's the key to the 2016 PGA Tour landscape, is remembering that it's not just these big three, big four, big five. It's not just the Bubbas and the Adam Scotts that are able to go out there and take down these tournaments. The golf is still deep, and it's not just young guys. I mean, there's 30-year-old players that can win majors. There are 35-year-old guys that can still come out and are still trying to get that first PGA Tour win, and I thought Brian Stewart was a great example of that. I mean, it was impressive because it was surprising, and that's what I loved about it. And it's just a reminder that we focus so much, we look at odds all the time of these top-notch players, just remembering that, you know, much like European soccer, a no-name can come out and do it on any given week. And so I just thought it was cool to see that as well. I mean, you know, maybe we root for the big guys more often than we don't, but I also like to see these people that have played 120 some odd golf tournaments finally getting that first win and getting it in that fashion. Not somebody losing it necessarily, but him going out and winning it. Of course, you want to get in touch with us, you can hit me up on Twitter at Shane Bacon, at the Clubhouse Pod. The hashtag is Clubhouse SB. If you want to send in a question, a lengthier one, the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon at gmail.com. Not going to do mailbag this week because I'm writing up a big one for FoxSports.com on Thursday, so make sure you check that out. Joe Poznanski is coming on. NBC Sports, one of the great writers out there, was at the Masters, wrote some incredible pieces. If you haven't checked it out, make sure you go look at his Joe blog. Really, if you Google Joe blog, it'll be the first thing that pops up. That's the easiest way. He also has a podcast as well called The Poscast, so make sure you give that a listen whenever you get a chance. And from there, we turn to another guy that is making a career change this week. John Daly turns 50, playing on the PGA Tour Champions this week, which brings us to a new fun segment we have called What Event in Golf Would Have Broken Twitter? The reason this is perfect is because both of John Daly's major wins, I believe, would have broken Twitter for good, especially golf Twitter, at least for a few weeks. You think back to 1991 and just go back for a minute and think. Seventh alternate, nobody knows who he is, drives overnight to make this event at Crooked Stick, and goes out and wins the PGA Championship. He wins a major as a complete no-name, getting in last second, doesn't have the prep time. I think the mentality of that is so crazy, to think that somebody like that could come into an event and not just be comfortable and confident that they could play, but be comfortable and confident that they could win. And I think that is such a unique characteristic to John Daly. Obviously, a guy that dominated the tour with driving distance over the years, but was also an incredible talent. I mean, you've heard the famous story about Tiger Woods saying, you know, John Daly asking him to have a beer with him, and he's saying, you know, if I had as much talent as you, I wouldn't have to go practice, as he made his way to the range, obviously giving John Daly a little bump there. Another one that would have broken Twitter, 1995 British Open. I think Daly, again, getting in competition, the mullet, the Reebok sweatshirt, a lot of those things would have had the interest. But really, the way it went down at the end, the Rocca chip in from the Valley of Sin after flubbing the first one, I think we all would have gone absolutely nuts seeing that. And then, of course, Daly getting back, regrouping, and going out and winning the Claret Jug for a second major. That would have broke Twitter. 1986 Masters, I mean, that's obvious. I'm not even sure Twitter would have been around after that. I really actually believe that could have actually broken the social media site. I think of 1966, the final round. You know, we all saw what happened with Jordan Spieth at the Masters this year. I think 1966 with Arnold Palmer, a seven-shot lead with nine holes to play, with all the love that was around and surrounded Arnold Palmer at that time, with the fans that literally would fall over just to get a glimpse of the guy, having that big of a lead and letting it slip away, I think that would have just been one of those meltdown moments on social media that we all just wouldn't know what to say. It would have just probably just been emoticons and GIFs and memes because we wouldn't have known really how to handle it. 1996, of course, with Greg Norman. Those are the ones that came to mind. I was trying to think of exactly what moment in golf would have broken Twitter. I think the number one moment of all of those things is the Ryder Cup and the Justin Leonard putt. I think the comeback, we all would have been talking about it. The buildup would have been heavy and high. But I think you factor in the Leonard putt, the controversy after, and it would have been an epic, epic moment on golf Twitter. So those are mine. If you have some yourself, send them in. Use the hashtag ClubhouseSB. I'll retweet a few of my favorites. Moments you think would have broken Twitter. Of course, you can bring up John Vandeveld. I mean, there's a lot of moments out there in golf that were so surprising and shocking that if they'd have been around, we all would have just relied on Twitter to get us through it. I mean, I think that's a little bit of what happened there when you saw with Jordan Spieth. My winning tweet of the week has nothing to do with the PGA Tour event. It was from Brad Lindenberg. Brad Runs Far is his Twitter account, and we'll retweet that on the Clubhouse Pod account as well so you can get a look. First birthday party of success. Older brother caddied. And his first birthday, his son, obviously is cute enough as it is, a little makeshift mini green jacket. And his brother, older brother, had the white caddy suit on, Lindenberg on the back. As I mentioned, we'll retweet that. But if you want to go take a look, Brad Runs Far is the handle. And I'll say, it's probably the cutest thing I've seen in a long time, especially involving golf. I was a big fan of it. I will be at PGA Tour Live this week. I'll be hosting on Thursday and Friday. So if you don't do PGA Tour Live, come on. What are you doing? It's like $40. Thursday, we will have Matsuyama, Ricky Fowler, Rory McIlroy. We will have Stewart coming off the win, Jim Furyk's return, and Patrick Reed, which is always exciting. So those will be our featured groups on Thursday. Friday, we have J.B. Holmes, Webb Simpson, Mr. Phil Mickelson, Adam Scott, Justin Rose, and Bill Haas. So that'll be fun. Wells Fargo week, always a good one. Great memories from some big players there, of course, with Phil and Rory and all that. So I think this is the start of it. Here we go. I mean, we had our little break after the Masters, and golf season is about to ramp up because, you know, we're nearing Oakmont. I mean, we're some 40 days away from the U.S. Open, and right after that ends, the focus will be on the Open Championship, the PGA, the Olympics, the FedEx, and all that. So here we go. This is the time. But before we get to all that, let's have a chat. Joe, on the podcast, obviously has a great book out, Secret of Golf, talking Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus. A really, really respected writer in the industry. I love when he comes to golf tournaments. I love the way he writes. So we had a really good conversation, lengthy conversation. Hit on Tom, hit on Jack. Hit a lot on Tiger, actually. A lot on Mr. Tiger Woods, which is a little surprising. I try not to talk too much Tiger on the podcast until he plays. But, you know, with some of the announcements and some of the rumors that are circling, I thought it was worthy of bringing up Tiger Woods. So here we go. Joe, on the podcast. NBC Sports national columnist Joe Posnanski, one of the best writers out there. You can find all of his work at his Joe blog. His podcast is called The Poscast, available where podcasts can be found. His fourth book, The Secret of Golf, the story of Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus, takes you through the relationship and the rivalry of two of the greatest to ever pick up a five iron. Joe, nice enough to join us from Pittsburgh. Joe, you going to get a chance to get out and play a few holes out at Oakmont?
Yeah, probably not going to get to do that. pretty close to the ice here, but we'll be back. We'll be back for Oakmont. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I got a chance to play Oakmont last week, part of our Fox Sports field trip, if you will, for the broadcasters when we go check out the U.S. Open venue. First time for me to go around it. In your years covering golf, Is there a tougher test of golf out there for these players in really any situation than an Oakmont U.S. Open?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. You know, I mean, obviously, Pinehurst offers its kind of crazy challenges, and we all remember the war on the shore and, you know, Carnoustie and some of the other places. But it's pretty tough to top Oakmont, especially when they set that thing up for U.S. Open toughness. It'll be something. I think that's really cool. I mean, you couldn't do an Oakmont kind of U.S. Open every year, I don't think. But every few years to just put those guys into that really, really difficult situation, I think is great.
Yeah, I mean, are you a fan? You mentioned Pinehurst and Oakmont, and I think of Wingfoot and you know, Pebble Beach when I think of U.S. Open courses. Are you a fan of some of these new age courses that the USGA is trying out, like Chambers Bay and next year with Erin Hills?
Well, I have to admit I was not at all a fan of Chambers Bay. I like the idea of them kind of opening things up and trying new things, and certainly like the idea of bringing the U.S. Open to different parts of the country and try. I like that. I like it sort of in the general sense. But I kind of thought Chambers Bay was kind of a fiasco. I mean, you can't have greens that people can't putt on. You can't put the U.S. Open in the hands of, you know, 12, 15-foot putts where the ball might, fall into a little hole or something. I mean, I don't think that was good. And it's a shame. It's a beautiful golf course over at Chambers Bay, but I didn't think that was a great test. But I do like the idea of opening it up. I mean, you and I agree. I mean, I like the traditional golf courses. I love it when they bring it to Pebble Beach. I like it at Pinehurst, even though Pinehurst has its issues, obviously. Oakmont, I love them trying the tradition and bringing the history in. And I don't mind them opening it up, but I think they probably need to make a little bit better decision, I think, than Chambers Bay.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking major championships, talking the U.S. Open, obviously coming off of a crazy Masters, and there's a lot to be talked about with that. But, you know, you're close with Tom Watson, and you've written a book about Tom Watson. You know him very well. You were at Augusta as Tom said goodbye to the Masters. You know, he is 66 years old. Why do you feel like Tom, in particular, was able to keep up with the young guns for so much longer than a lot of players? Because, you know, you see legends of the game who can't really compete when they get into their mid-50s, and here he is at 66 still able to get it around.
Yeah, I find that interesting, you know, and I think there are great examples of what you're saying. I mean, look at Nick Faldo. I mean, it's been so many years since Nick has been, you know, even able to sort of just, you know, almost even a ceremonial way, you know, hit it around, you know, places like Augusta. I think it speaks to two things with Tom. One is just his extreme competitive nature. I think it's the same thing that kept Jack Nicklaus going for so long. He still wants to win. I don't think that there's even one speck of a difference between how much he wants to win now compared to how much he wanted to win in 1977. I mean, I think there's a realism that comes along with age, and something that certainly he's had struggles, coming to grips with. But you eventually have to come to grips with those things. But I think competitively, he's exactly the same. So I think that's one. I don't think the hunger has ever left him, as we saw sort of in not the best light at the Ryder Cup. And then the second thing is, I just think Tom, once he figured it out, you know, in the early 90s again, I mean, he's still one of the great ball strikers in the world. I mean, it's just extraordinary. He can't hit it for distance anymore, and that's a big deal. But he's just a magnificent ball striker. He can do everything with the ball. It's what made him as good a wind player as really has ever played the game. And I think that, you know, on the right kind of golf course, on the right kind of day, as we saw, you know, at Turnberry in 2009. He can still compete with anybody. Now he doesn't have the length anymore, and I think he wouldn't want to admit it, but I think he would admit over the last 3 or 4 years his game has fallen off even beyond, you know, the length issues. But you know, until he was 60 years old, I think on the right day and on the right golf course he could compete with anybody just because he's such a good ball striker.
Well, you brought it up, the 2009 Open. I just wanted to ask you, just personally, not even as a media member, as a writer, but personally, have you ever covered something that was more disappointing at the end than that 09 Open where we obviously ended up losing to Stewart Cink?
No, it was the biggest letdown I think I've ever been around in sports. Not so much, you know. Sure, there's a personal issue. I've known Tom for a long time, and you know, I've written a book about Tom since then, and you know, feel like I know him, and we've shared a lot through the years. But it was just such a good story. It was just such a good story. It was, you know, a guy who was almost 60, a guy who had just come off a hip replacement, but also a guy who really, you know, was in the wilderness for a long time. I mean, he was the best player in the world for seven or eight years, you know, literally PGA Tour Player of the Year just about every year between 77 and 84. You know, won 8 majors and was a dominant player and was still young enough that you thought it was going to go on for a few more years, and then it just disappeared. You know, lost his swing, he lost his confidence, and then he couldn't make a putt for about 20 years. So for that person to come back at age 60 and just about win the British Open, would have been, I think, the biggest story in the history of golf, or, you know, right there, certainly with Jack at 46 and with Ben Hogan off of the injury and all of the other historic things that we remember from golf, it would have been as big as any of them, if not bigger. I think he would have been Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year had he won it. I mean, it just would have been such a huge story, and to come so close and to have it end, you know, in such heartbreaking fashion, that's about as disappointing as it can get in sports, I think.
Yeah, and it was at least from my end, and I mean, I was viewing it on a TV. I wasn't over there at Turnberry, but it seemed when the playoffs started, it was a dead man walking situation. I just never felt like he's going to win it. I mean, he had that putt, and it was a shaky stroke, and, you know, he had a great shot into the 72nd hole, and he missed that par putt. And to me, it was like, there's no way he's going to be able to do this. I think 72 holes was as far as he was going to go. But, you know, I wanted to touch on your book, The Secret of Golf, where you talked about Tom and Jack's relationship. What was the relationship like? Would you consider them friends? Were they rivals? Did they respect each other? Because I think a lot of the younger people don't exactly know, not only, you know, Tom's kind of up-and-comingness to the game, but how Jack got started and how people were mean to Jack Nicklaus. I mean, they did not like the guy because he was taking away, you know, their hero in Arnold Palmer.
That's right. I mean, it's and, you know, Tom Watson was one of those people. Tom was a big Arnold Palmer fan. And he didn't like Jack. You know, this is as a kid. Nobody did. Almost nobody did. Jack had so few fans in those early years when he came on. And I think Jack would be the first one to tell you. I mean, he was a little bit arrogant. He came across that way. He kind of came across as a little bit of a know-it-all. You know, Jack realized very early on, you know, because he have the greatest golf career ever, but I think he's the smartest, you know, sort of most penetrating thinker in the history of golf. And he knew right away, within, you know, a couple of years of turning professional, that he was better than Palmer. I mean, he knew it. He understood that he was the best player in the world and certainly had that, you know, that ability to do that. And he loved it. He loved the pressure of it. He loved the challenge. And, you know, he didn't come across very well. Of course, he was a big guy then. Everybody called him Fat Jack. And there was just this sense that he was taking the game away from this people's champion that was Arnold Palmer. And Jack, you know, overcame all of that. And you know, over time, won people over to them because they saw that you know, he's a profoundly decent person and a family man and a guy who, it's not really arrogance. It's much more just this sense of who he is that he has going for himself. And by the time Tom came up, Jack was, you know, king of the world. And there really wasn't, you know, there'd been all these golfers who had come along and come close, you know, and some of them even got the better of him for a time, Lou Trevino beat him a couple of times and all of that. But there was still this sense, when Watson was first starting, that he was just one of the many, you know, to come along and try to unseat the champion, and it turned out that Tom was the one that would end up doing it, was the one that would end up taking sort of that number one spot in the world away from Jack. And they did respect each other, but I think over the years that respect has turned into something, you know, a lot more. I mean, it's really a very, very cool friendship that they have for each other. They're very, very different people. But they, you know, they're the only ones who know what it was like, you know, playing those last 36 holes of Turnberry at the, you know, in 77 at the Open Championship. The only ones who know what it was like, you know, that last day at Pebble Beach in 82 when Tom Watson chips in. You know, they to me, in a lot of ways, that's the last rivalry in golf, because it wasn't just that these two were fighting for number one in the world and all of these major championships. It's that they were doing it, you know, on the same stage. And I think it's really, striking when you look at Tiger and Phil, who I would always consider, you know, sort of the rivals if you had them. But they never really competed for the same major championship. They never played in the final day together, you know, with one of, or the other going to win the Masters or something like that. But that happened repeatedly to Tom and Jack. So I think it's a unique rivalry. I think it's a unique friendship that has lasted all the years. And, you know, even now they get together and there's just this fun, you know, feeling, you know, when you're just dealing with a couple of people who have, who have known each other for so long and competed with each other so much. And there's so many emotions between them. I mean, it's very, very cool to see them together.
Is there a modern day equivalent to the way fans would treat Jack that comes to mind? I mean, is Sergio at Bethpage the closest thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I was trying to think about that. I don't know that there is even Sergio is quite like it. I think, you know, it's easy to forget that when Arnold first really, you know, moved to the top of the golf world, when he had the army, you know, behind him, it was really the first time that golf had become sort of this everyman sport that you know, people have, I think, now somewhat, you know, have come to see. I mean, golf was, you know, it was a country club sport. It was for the country club people. And while certainly everybody admired, you know, the great players of the past, Arnold sort of changed that whole dynamic. So you have all of these people who have come to the sport because of Arnold Palmer, because, you know, of this, you know, Pennsylvania guy with a cigarette in his mouth and the crazy swing and all of that sort of thing. And then here's Jack that comes along and is taken away from him. And I think it's pretty clear to everybody, you know, that Jack is, you know, a better player, you know, when you look at, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of the two players. And I think that's really tough. So I don't think there's anybody who's exactly like that. I think if somebody, I don't know that Tiger was, you know, there were so many people who love Tiger. I don't know if somebody had come along in Tiger's heyday and had kind of just come along and taken it away from him for a little bit. Maybe if somebody like that had, you know, could have sort of filled that role. But I just don't think there's anybody as popular as Arnold is in the world right now for them to stir those kinds of emotions.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You touched on it a moment ago, and it's one of the things. It's the real big regret of the Tiger era. And a lot of people might focus on now being a regret of the Tiger era, that he's still 40 years old and can't swing right now and isn't playing. But, you know, to me, the biggest regret growing up watching Tiger was the people that played Tiger and even the people that beat Tiger were no names. I mean, Rich Beam comes to mind, of course, Y.A. Ying comes up, Chris DeMarco takes some links at Augusta, but you never had the Phil, you never had VJ, you know, you had Ernie at a time, but I mean, it just never seemed like it was in that big moment. Every time Tiger had somebody that was competing against him, it was a no-name guy having an epic week, a la Bob May, and I just always had hoped that we'd have somebody come up, and it's interesting now, and you wrote about this, on Saturday at the Masters this year, we had it. I mean, I've been saying it for months. We want Jordan versus Rory. That's what the golf world wants. I mean, if we don't get Phil and we don't get Tiger, that's what we want. And we got it, and you wrote about it. I mean, it was, I think it's the only round Rory's ever played in a major that he didn't make a birdie, and he even said before, I don't look at the names, and you kind of called him out and said, You don't really buy that. I mean, it was a really weird day when you consider Rory as, you know, the major next big thing, and Spieth kind of come on late, and Rory was the one that succumbed to the round.
Yeah, I think it was. First of all, that was really weird. I mean, Rory, there was something about Rory that whole tournament, you know, the way he sort of was trying to convince himself that, you know, hey, maybe if I pretend to care less about this, it won't be as much. And, you know, there was something really weird. And you know, I remember, I'm going to say it was probably 2000 or 2001, maybe somewhere in that range. You know, Tom Watson used to always have this charity golf tournament in Kansas City. It was just, he would bring four people to come play, and they would do like a little clinic, and it would raise a ton of money for Children's Mercy Hospital. And it was a great event. So one of the last ones, he got Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, and Lee Trevino to all come. So it was sort of this historic event where the five of them were all in the same place on the same day. And they held a little press conference beforehand, and I remember how angry they were that none of the other golfers felt like they could challenge Tiger. I mean, they just felt like there was this extreme sort of resignation all around golf that everybody just kind of assumed, hey, look, we can't beat Tiger. All we can really do is play for second or play to win on a week that he isn't very good. And they were so, I mean, it was truly anger. They were angry because their feeling was, hey, why play this game?
Right.
If you don't see this as the greatest challenge in the world, hey, here is the, you know, I don't think anybody ever played golf better than Tiger Woods in that stretch of time. Here's the best. Don't you want to beat him? That's your goal. That's your job. And you know, Tiger made life pretty good for finishing second place. You were making a whole lot more money doing that. And I'm not saying that these guys lack competitiveness, because I don't think you would ever say that about Ernie or Phil or Vijay. Those guys wanted to win. But there was a little bit of a sense that they weren't quite good enough. And I think that is a regret of the Tiger era. I think there's a regret that nobody who, you know, there were players who did this, but nobody of that very, very top ilk sort of, you know, I think of the movie, you know, I think of the Rocky movie, just like took a picture of Tiger and put it up in their mirror and stared at it every day, like, I'm coming to get you. You didn't get that feeling. You kind of got this feeling that it was the Tiger show for about 10 years, and all these other guys, yeah, they were great players and they're Hall of Fame players, but they didn't really try to be Tiger Woods, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I always said, I mean, I'm a big believer in moments in golf. I think, you know, you can have a moment and it can propel you to something great. I mean, look at Spieth. You know, Spieth wins the Masters last year, plays obviously out of his mind, and that propelled him to an incredible season, one of the best we've seen, you know, really in the major era. I mean, the way he played, almost winning all four majors. But, you know, if he doesn't win the Masters, if he has the collapse he had this year, last year, you know, that he could really realistically never win a major. I mean, I think of Sergio a lot. Sergio always comes to my mind as a guy when people always go, oh, they'll win one, like Ricky Fowler or Dustin. Oh, they'll win a major. They'll win one eventually. And I said, you know, we all said that about Sergio. We all said that about Lee Westwood and Luke Donald. I mean, you know, sometimes things can really break your spirit. To me, Tiger just broke spirits all the time. I mean, anytime you get somewhat close, he'd break it. And what you said about Rory, I found so interesting because I agree with you. It seemed like he was trying to play himself up to something that he's not. And I mean, I've talked to Rory. I think he's a really nice kid, and he seems to get in that you know, alpha male moment on the golf course. But it doesn't really seem like that's his personality off. And I thought it was funny when he was just mentioning, I don't even look at the names, or, you know, I'm not worried about that, because of course he is. And you even wrote that. I mean, of course he's paying attention to this stuff. He knows who he's playing. He knows who's chasing him down the leaderboard. I mean, you have to get a sense of what you got to do.
Sure. And I mean, you know, for him to say, hey, I don't look at the name when it's Jordan Spieth, who is really the guy that knocked him off the front page. Sure. He knows. Of course he knows. And you'd think less of him if he didn't know, you know. Right. You would think if, again, they're all such, you know, they're so competitive. I think often about Nick Price. You know, Nick Price had that period of time where he was the best player in the world, and he's the nicest guy, you know, he's the single nicest guy out there. He's just couldn't be a better person. But I don't think he liked it. I don't think he liked being number one in the world. I don't think he liked all of the requests and all of the pressure that comes with it and all of the sense of responsibility that goes with being the, I don't think he liked that at all. And he didn't, you know, precisely say that, but he said a lot of things that suggested that he was more than happy not to be number one in the world. And not to say that's Rory, because Rory is, you know, first of all, I mean, he's so talented and he's, you know, he's done things that Nick Price didn't do. But you do wonder, when he's trying to play mind games with himself, you know, going into the Masters. I mean, that's one thing that was so beautiful about the Tiger era. Tiger, every single tournament, you know, you'd ask him, you know, what are you thinking? I'm here to win. And there was no, hey, I found a new putter in the back of my car. I'm thinking, you know, that this is going to change my, you know. I mean, he changed his swing a lot and did all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, he's like, I'm here to be the champion. I'm here to put on the green jacket. I'm here to win the Open Championship. It was never, there was no mind games that he had to play with himself, at least publicly. And with Phil, we've seen a billion different mind games. Now he's studying Tai Chi, now he's doing this. And I think that's how a lot of guys are, and that seems to be the trap Rory's falling into. It's just a Rory school play.
Right.
Just, you know, you're a great player, and Augusta is, like, made for you. Just go out there and play the thing, and you know, you play at your peak, you're going to win a green jacket. So just go out there and play. But I really think something you said earlier about, you know, singular moments, I think is very, very true and very, you know, I think it's important when you look at golf. I mean, there's no question you see, like, players that get close to winning a major, especially when they're younger, and you say, well, there's plenty of time. But you know what? There isn't. It's like you've got to win it when the opportunity's there. You're not going to get that many. You're going to get lots of opportunities to play, but you're not going to get that many opportunities to win. And so when Sergio or a Lee Westwood or Luke Donald or you know, heck, Ricky is, we're getting to that point with Ricky Fowler.
Right.
You get to that point where you're close, you better close the deal. It's not like those opportunities are just going to be there time and time and time again. I don't believe that. I think that's how you end up with a career without a major championship.
Yeah, I mean, think about Tiger. I mean, we've brought his name up a few times, and he's obviously been in the news lately with when he's going to come back. But, I mean, Tiger wins in 08 at the U.S. Open, and, I mean, we would have lost a lot of money in Las Vegas if somebody would have made us bet on how many more majors he was going to win, because we probably would have said five. I mean, or at least, you know, and not to go on and get another one and get, you know, beat by Y.E. Yang, of all people. It's so crazy. And I wanted to ask you, you said, you know, the last rivalry in golf was Tom Watson, Jack Nicklaus. Is there any chance of a rivalry between Rory and Jordan? I mean, it doesn't seem like they're best buds. I mean, I think there's been accounts of them just kind of, they get along fine. But, you know, even this spring break 2017 thing on Snapchat the past couple of weeks with Ricky and Smalley Coffin and Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas down there in the Bahamas, you know, and Rory saying, I should have come along. I just feel like with all the money and the sponsorships and the life that these guys have, it's probably really hard to want to beat someone really bad, you know, week in and week out. Because, you know, I mean, even if you finish fourth, as you mentioned with the Tiger era, you finish fourth and life's still pretty good.
Oh, yeah, no question. But I will say this. I think there's a competitive nature that is in a lot of people, you know, the very, very best people. And they want to be the best in the world. It's not about the money, and it's not about the fame, and it's not about anything other than they're playing this sport to become the best in the world. And you see that in Jordan for sure. He absolutely is driven to be the best. I think you see that in Jason Day. I think you see that certainly in spurts with Rory. You know, I think when you have that competitive nature, here's what I've often said about rivalries. What made the Watson-Nicklaus rivalry great is not the fact that they were going for the same thing and they ended up, you know, really competing at a high level and you know, all of those things and the contrasting styles and all of the things that make, you know, for good writing about rivalries. What made it a great rivalry is that three times on the biggest stage in the world, they faced off against each other. And that to me, if we get at this U.S. Open, Rory and Jordan playing together on Sunday with those two guys having a chance to win, and one of them wins it, we got the beginning of a rivalry. I mean, that to me is what it takes. And what it takes is them being on the biggest stages in golf, with everything on the line, and they're facing against each other. You know, whether they're paired together or whether they're, you know, one or two groups apart, those two, you know, pushing each other, pushing the limits. And I think you throw Jason Day in that as well. That to me is what makes a great rivalry, and we haven't had that. Look, Phil and Tiger should have been a great rivalry. They clearly have very mixed feelings about each other. Tremendously contrasting styles, both American players. You know, there was everything was there for a rivalry. They just never ended up having that moment, and I think that's what we need. I think to have a great rivalry in golf again.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about Tiger, and you have to give me your honest assessment and thoughts on what we're going to see. Tiger's going to come back at some point in the next, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. I'm going to guess Memorial, but we'll see. What do you think is a realistic expectation of Tiger Woods, not only the rest of his 2016, but all of 2017? What do you think is realistic for golf fans to think about as they view Tiger coming back to golf and playing again?
Well, okay,
that was the perfect response.
Yeah, well, because we're talking realistic. With Tiger, you never know. There's lots of possibilities, lots of things. The realistic hope is that Tiger stays healthy enough to play 2016, 2017, and on. That is the realistic best hope. Now, how good he plays, how well he does, that's all going to depend on how healthy he can stay. And I don't buy that that's going to be easy at all. I just think competitive golf is, you know, he's always had a very, very violent swing. I don't see how he's toning that down at this point in his life, at this point in his career. He's going to want to win. If he's out there, he's going to want to be as competitive as he can. So, you know, can he adjust and stay healthy and be healthy enough out there? I think that's such a big question. I'm not even sure that it is realistic to hope for that. You know, I said a few years ago, and you know, I don't mean to make it sound like I was on an island, but I said a few years ago that I didn't think he was going to break Jack's record because you age faster in golf than you think. And that people want to always say, oh, he's got 10 more of this, and 10 more years, 15 more years, whatever. But realistically, you age at a very similar way to the way pitchers age in baseball. I mean, you get a few more years on the back end. You have a few guys that can go on and really be successful into their 40s. But that's true of pitchers, too. It's pretty similar. And he's 40 years old, and he's been through, we don't even know how many surgeries he's been through. It's the back, which is the worst possible scenario. So, you know, I think that's got to be hope number one. Hope number one is, hey, he can go out there and he can be healthy. Healthy enough to go out there and play however many times a year he wants to play. And then, you know, if he can actually be healthy and swing the club without pain, sure, he's still Tiger Woods. And, right. And he can find ways to do some really cool things, I think. But that health question to me, I just can't let go of it.
Well, I mean, I think that we haven't seen him come back and even be remotely healthy in a long, long time. So it's almost, you know, I mean, the sample size of late, I mean, really since probably 07, the guy hasn't been healthy. And I mean, that's a long time when you're on 10 years of him basically being unhealthy when he plays golf, and he'll come back for the 3 or 4 stretches of tournaments and then, you know, grabs his back, grabs his knee. That's what I've said. I'm actually surprised he's coming back. I wrote before the year that I didn't think we'd see him in 2016. I think I'm gonna be very surprised if and when he comes back, and it sure seems like he wants to and he's trying to. But I still don't understand the rush at this point. I mean, 40 or 41 is the same for Tiger Woods. But you know, you're a writer. You root for the story, right? I mean, that's the whole idea. Let's root for the story. I mean, you mentioned Tom Watson winning 09. That's a great story. I put together my top 5 U.S. Open storylines that I think that would be the best ones out there. And let me know if you agree or disagree with my five. Number one, Tiger somehow wins major number 15. Very unlikely,
of course.
But I think that's number one. Number two, Phil completes the Grand Slam, finally gets the U.S. Open trophy. I think that would be ahead of any of the young guys winning. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think that would be that would be amazing if he could do it.
Especially with his record at Oakmont, tied for 47th in 94, missed the cut in 07. Not a great course, I don't think, for Phil Mickelson's game, but you know, you never know. He's won on crazier golf courses in his career. Number three, I have Jordan Spieth bounce back win a la Rory in 2011.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that would be, you know what? I mean, I actually think that's pretty likely. I mean, I don't know that he's going to come back and win it, but I think he's going to come back and play well. I was one of those. We all were there, you know, in Augusta, and you know, saw it and kind of felt like, okay, well, this could be a career, not a career ender, of course, but a career crusher, and like send him on a completely different course. I don't think so. I really think that this guy's going to bounce back, and he's going to bounce back quick. So I like number three a lot.
And here's number four. Let's see what you think, because you wrote about him. Bryson DeChambeau wins the U.S. Open.
I got to say, if that actually happened, that might move up on the charts. He's what a character. What a character that guy is. And he's obviously really good. I mean, it's not... You know, I mean, I don't know, and you know, I'm curious to hear what you think about it. I don't know how much of this is show, and I don't even mean show in a negative way. I just mean like something that he has to say to himself to convince himself, and he's, you know, he's throwing out all of these formulas for how putts are breaking and all of the crazy physics he's doing. I don't know. I really don't know how much of that is real or how much of that is just kind of something that he needs to sort of boost his own confidence. But hey, he goes out there and wins with the, you know, clubs the same size and all of the crazy things that are going on in his head. He wins the U.S. Open. Yeah, that's a big time story.
Yeah, and you know, I followed him. I mean, you know, Fox covered the U.S. Amateur last year, and I was out there and I followed him a couple of days and covered him in the booth the final day for his first 18. And you know, it is an interesting approach, and it's something we've never seen, and I love the way you set it up in your piece, and I'll tweet the link out for people that haven't seen it, because I think it's a really good article. I love the way you set it up with comparing it to sabermetrics and the way all this science has moved into baseball and basketball, and now it's moving into golf. But, you know, I mean, this is a guy that pulled a dial out of his bag and showed us. He has a dial that shows how far back he takes certain wedges for certain distances, and, I mean, he's apparently trained his body, I mean, muscle memory, I guess, to move it back, you know, say it's hip height for a 40-yard pitch shot. And, I mean, I guess if you think about simplifying golf with a lot of science and math, I mean, I guess in a way it kind of makes sense. I'm all in on him. I think it's really interesting to watch, and I hope that the career works out for him, because if nothing else, it's something we've never seen in golf before. And to me, any kind of change is good for this game, especially right now.
I totally agree. I think it's great for golf. I mean, I think it's fantastic. The thing we'll have to see is how real is it? You know, we have to see. I mean, he's certainly impressed early on, and you know, but he hasn't won anything yet. He hasn't won. I mean, he's won plenty. I mean, he's won U.S. Amateur and all of that, but he hasn't won, you know, as a professional yet, and he hasn't, you know, but he goes out and does this at the U.S. Open, you know, at Oakmont. That would be a fantastic story, absolutely.
The hat sales would sure go up. All right, number five on my list, and I have 5A and 5B. 5A is Rory wins the U.S. Open. I just think him winning another major is a big story. And 5B is Sergio Garcia, finally a major champion. Is Sergio still a story? Do people still care about him?
I do. And I know, you know, I get it. I get why people have their feelings about Sergio. I kind of like him.
I do.
I just there's something very human about the guy. You know, I mean, he wears his emotions on his sleeve, and who among us hasn't hit a bad shot or done some, you know, made some mistake and basically cursed the world for you know, I mean, I just feel with him. I really do. And I'd love for that guy to win the US Open. I think that would be a great story. You know, I think, you know, on your list, I mean, you know, I think if Dustin Johnson won, I think that would be a very big story, especially when you look at some of the close misses he's had. Look, Ricky Fowler wins a major championship. I'm really amazed by how much Ricky Fowler connects with, especially with young people. I mean, I you know, he's the guy that you know, if my daughters happen to wander in the room when I'm watching golf, which doesn't happen that often, and they see him, they just are instantly drawn, whether it's the big cap or the bright colors he's wearing or whatever the case may be, they're just drawn to him. And it would be a very big story if he won the U.S. Open as well. But all of those guys that have not won one yet, I think those are the three that would really, really sort of shake the golf world a little bit.
I said it when I walked off Oakmont's 18th. I said, you know, if Ricky's swinging at it the way he swung at it in 14 and a lot of 15, you know, his putting stroke, I think it just continues to get better and better. And, I mean, you're going to – every player in the field at the U.S. Open is going to have to make between 4 and 6, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 footers for par every round. And I love the way Ricky putts, and I think he's going to have a chance. That being said, I mean, we've seen him have these blow-up opening rounds at the majors that are just out of nowhere. I mean, he did it at the Masters, did it last year at Chambers Bay. They're a little surprising. I wanted to ask you, give me your best Phil Mickelson story.
Wow, my best Phil Mickelson story. You know, I've had like this sort of long-standing, I wouldn't call it a love-hate thing because it's never been hate, but like this sense of Phil, you know, I found myself always on the opposite end of whatever the conversation is. So like if the conversation is about how Phil's kind of a phony, I'm kind of the one saying, no, he's a great guy, look at all the great things he's done. One of my favorite sort of general Phil stories is, you know, when Conrad Dobler, the old football player, had some real health issues in Kansas City. And it was something that I don't think was very well known. And I was in Kansas City at the time. And I believe we're the ones at the Star that ran a little story on him and the struggles he was going through. And Phil somehow got word of it. And very, very quietly, donated a ton of money to Conrad Dobler. I can't remember if it was money to put his daughter through college. I can't remember what the exact thing he did, but I know it was something that basically Conrad Dobler said, you know, we've met an angel, and that's Phil Mickelson. So somebody who does things that good, you know, there's just a real depth of goodness in them that does that. That said, I did not feel like Phil was on the right side of the Ryder Cup situation. I don't think Tom Watson was a good captain. I think he made a lot of mistakes, but I just don't think you ever do that to a legend of golf. You know, then especially in the heat of the moment like that, for him to just call out Tom and really, you know, say the things he said. And I know he was hurting and he was emotional and he wasn't alone, and there were other people who felt the same way. I get it, but that's not something you do, in my view. That's, you don't treat a legend in the game like that. I would be the first one to know that Tom can turn people off and irritate people because he is so intense and he's so competitive and he tends to believe he's right, and that's just who he is. But that's just not what you do. So there's the yin and yang of Phil Mickelson to me is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it was the moment when he said that at the Ryder Cup, when Phil said that about Tom Watson, I was thinking to myself, man, I really wish Phil had a Twitter account, because I feel like he'd be one of those guys that would just fire out some tweets that would since be deleted, but everybody would have screen grabbed a few times a year. I feel like that was a great open mic example of social media. All right, I'm going to ask you a couple rapid fire questions, and I'll let you go. We've been great, by the way. I appreciate you coming on. All right, first question, we've already touched on him. Ricky Fowler ends his 2016 season with blank majors.
Man, I mean, if I got to predict, I'm going to say zero. But I totally feel you on Oakmont. That could be the one. I would love to see that happen.
I think all three of these venues set up well for Ricky. I really do. You know, again, the surprise blow-up rounds, they've been stunning me, especially after the way he played in 14 at the majors, finishing top five in all four of them. They're just kind of out of nowhere, and I'm hoping, I don't know if it's, he's too amped up when he gets to the event and he's so fired up.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. I wonder if he's too amped up. You know, and there is a perfect example. Okay, so he finishes top five in all four majors, and really, you know, in the last one kind of had a chance to win. Didn't really have a chance to win in all of them, but still was there in contention in all four of them. But he didn't win. And just those opportunities, you know, you start questioning yourself and you start putting too much importance in it. And I think that's really tough. So I think the odds are all, if you ask me any player in the world to say, are they going to win a major championship this year? I'd have to say no, because I don't think you could bet on anybody, even Jordan, who I love. But I could definitely see him winning a major championship this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, you would say you think Danny Willett's going to win one in 16, but that would just be easy money. All right, if Lydia Ko played five PGA Tour tournaments, how many cuts does she make?
Okay, she gets to choose the five.
She can choose five.
Where she's okay, so she gets to choose what golf courses she's playing on.
Right.
All right, I'll be controversial. Four. I think she makes four cuts.
Right,
I think she chooses the right five golf tournaments, right five golf courses. I don't know. I must admit, I'm speaking off the top of my head, I'm not sure there are five tournaments like Colonial that the golf course would set up, you know, potentially for her or all that. But assuming she could choose five golf tournaments where length would not completely eliminate her, the way she strikes the ball and the way she putts, I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely on the far end, but I think she would definitely make cuts. I do think she would make cuts. You think she'd make any?
I think she would. I think she'd make a couple. I would. I want to see it. And, you know, the only issue with this is, I mean, we have this happen every decade or so. You know, obviously with Annika, with Michelle, you know, we've had these LPGA players attempt this. The only issue is if she misses the first couple of cuts, I think the news stories almost go away. And I think she'd need a couple under her belt just to feel comfortable, because it's a completely different beast. I mean, wherever she played would be the most media attention she's ever received in her life, even if it was, like you said, the Colonial or the John Deere, you know, the Waste Management. I mean, it would be the biggest, the most questions, the most media, the most interviews she's ever had. So I think it would take a couple to get comfortable. But I'd like to see her try. I mean, if she keeps winning majors at this rate, she's probably going to, just to keep her interest up. Okay, you can...
I'd love to see it.
Oh, I would. I think it'd be awesome. Okay, you can only pick one of the three things.
Okay.
You can pick, you're going to play golf. You can pick great greens, you can pick a 3.5 hour round of golf, or a great group of buddies, you know, instead of playing with just some no-names you don't know. What are you picking?
It's a great group of buddies, so these are people that I know, or like I get to choose, like, celebrities?
You can choose your friends.
Oh, then I would definitely choose the friends thing. I don't care. I don't care how good the greens are, and I don't care how fast the round is. It's going to be a disaster for me. The only way I could play a 3.5 hour round of golf is if I've given up on the balls I've hit in the water. I've just given up on it.
Yeah, well,
just saying, all right, the hole's over. The water counts as my shot.
Well, it's what I always say about, there's a good bad golfer and a bad bad golfer, and the good bad golfer at least acknowledges the fact that they're not very good at the game and can keep up with pace and drops it in the right spot. And there's the bad bad golfer that hits it in the desert and re-tees and hits it in the desert and re-tees, and you're just sitting in the cart going, man, I'm never going to finish this round of golf.
Yeah, I think it's I'm certainly a bad golfer, you know, whatever that means. But there's nobody knows that better than me. So I would say that I would always play, especially if I'm playing with somebody better than me, which would be 100% of the time. I'm gonna let them dictate the round. I'm not gonna get in the way of their round. So we'll do what we have to do.
Over under a half more major wins for Phil Mickelson.
The rest of his career?
The rest of his career.
So he has five now. So I'm saying he's going to win one more, is what you're saying. Is
right.
That's the over. No, I'm going to take the under. I think we're done. I know if he's going to do it, I don't think it's going to be at the U.S. Open or anything like that. I don't think that's going to happen. But he could have another Masters year where everything comes together for him. It could happen. But he's, you know, we're at Jack's age now. I mean, this
right.
is we're definitely at that line. And the question I have for him, you know, with him is, you know, he's still playing at a very, very high level, you know, and you know, during the season. I do wonder if we're going to start to see that drop off.
Right.
You know, I mean, he says he feels great. And he does have a nice, easy swing, so it's, he doesn't have the same situation as Tiger, but I'm going to go the under. What are you doing?
I'm going to go over. I think he wins. I think with his length, he could be competitive at Augusta for another 10 years. I just think he hits it far enough, and he knows that course well enough. I'm with you, though. I think if it happens, it's going to be at the Masters. I will say this, and I've looked this up a few times. The U.S. Open venues moving forward after this year are very Phil-friendly. I mean, he gets Wingfoot again. He gets Shinnecock. He gets to go to Torrey. I think Pebble's coming up at some point. You know, he's going to be near 50 at that point. But I think these are golf courses where he has positive memories. And when he gets there, he'll at least prepare his year for that major, I believe. And I just think that, do I think he'll win a U.S. Open? Honestly, probably not. But I think the venues are at least setting up for him to make a couple of runs.
I hope he does, and I hope I'm there. I mean, it would be a great, great story, and I just wouldn't take that bet. You know, I just
right.
that's too close. You know, to know whether or not he's going to win another one.
Over under a half PGA Tour wins for the rest of Tiger Woods, the rest of his career.
I'm going to take the over, but I don't know what that means. I kind of thought what you thought. I thought he wasn't going to come back until he was 100% healthy. I just thought he was going to, no matter how long it took, it doesn't matter. The rust is not an issue, and you know, rebuilding his swing, he'll do all that stuff anyway. So my feeling was, hey, he'll come back. He will be completely healthy. He'll be able to play again, and he plays again. He'll play enough tournaments that he can win again. And I do think, I don't know that it's a great sign that it looks like he's going to rush back.
It doesn't make any sense to me either. I've been so confused by this. He's done it every time. I mean, it literally is, he's continuing to make the same error over and over again. I mean, take a year and a half away. Again, like I said, 41 and 40 are not that different. And if he's 100% healthy and he's 41, he has at least a chance to come back and be a pro golfer again. I'm so confused if things are still off. He's rushing back to do this. I mean, does he love Royal Troon? Is he excited about Oakmont? I mean, there's got to be a reason. I'm not exactly sure why. But what do you have coming up? I mean, obviously you're covering the NHL playoffs. You're going to be at the U.S. Open. You're going to be at some other majors as well.
I'm going to be at the U.S. Open, but then you know, I will be in Rio, so that's going to take me out of. I'll get to see some golf over there. I think that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, if anybody shows up, if all these guys actually show up. This has been really crazy with all these guys dropping out. I will say, I think once they see what happens and they see a golfer with a gold medal, I could see 4 years from now everybody being a little bit more on board. But it's been a bit strange.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have like these long lists of rules of what I believe the Olympics should be. And one of my big rules is a sport should only be at the Olympics if it's the number one thing in its sport. So that's why I didn't like it in baseball. And I'm not really crazy about it in tennis, although tennis has sort of worked around that and made the gold medal sort of this, you know, it's still important to those people. I don't know that it's ever going to be that golf. I mean, I think it's great. It's going to be kind of, you know, a unique experience and interesting. But, I think it's been pretty clear every one of those people would rather win the John Deere Classic than win it, you know. And so that's not a good starting point. And I'm not sure that Rio is going to change a lot of minds. I don't know, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like they're going to have to make it just something with the PGA Tour, European Tour, where if you win a medal, you get an exemption or you get a couple of years on tour. I mean, give them some incentive to be there, because if you're a guy that's in an event and you're competing to make the FedEx Cup or, you know, or trying to get into the PGA Championship or something like that, you know, you'd much rather go get those points than you would to go battle 4 days at a stroke play event on a course you don't know that well. You know, my issue with the Olympics and golf, and I've said this a lot, is I think that if they'd have made it a two-man event and had two guys playing as a team, much like in like a Ryder Cup style format, where maybe you're playing another opponent, or maybe you're playing another country or something every day, and almost make it match play like that. I think at least that'd be something different for these guys, where Jordan and Ricky could go, let's go down there and win this thing and win gold medals together, as opposed to win it individually.
Totally agree. Actually, what I would love to see at the Olympics is to do that four-man, as fast as you can make the whole thing, that Sergio video that was on YouTube.
Speed golf, I love it.
Speed golf, one. I mean, I think that would be the great. You'd have heat, and then you would go to the semifinals of the final. It'd be like the 100-meter dash, only you'd have teams. I think that would be fantastic. I really don't understand why you would have the golf at the Olympics and not make it fun.
Make it different. Just make it different. Yeah. If that speed golf thing comes to fruition, I will literally go to golf courses during events and spike or poison certain American players so Phil Mickelson could be on that team, because I want to watch Phil Mickelson play speed golf for a couple of holes. I would pay-per-view that. I'd pay $10 or $12 an hour for that. Joey, I appreciate you coming on. It's been a lot of fun. Check out his book, The Secret of Golf. You can find him and really all over the internet as well. And your podcast is great as well. So thanks, and we will see you at Oakmont.
Absolutely. Thanks, Shane.
Well, that'll do it. Episode 10 of The Clubhouse. It's been fun. I'm enjoying it so far. I hope you're enjoying it. Any feedback you have, you can send us an email to clubhousewithshanebacon@gmail.com. You can send in questions, #ClubhouseSB. If you have questions for the mailbag, the print version, the written version, make sure you get those in as well. I've got a few already that I really like. Follow us at The Clubhouse Pod and at Shane Bacon. And if you like this, do me a favor. Go on iTunes, write a review. Hopefully it's positive. It really helps out in the ratings and how people take it in and where it goes on the list and the categories. And hopefully we'll get more listeners and all that. So do that for me. Subscribe. Tell some friends. Tell your buddies. Tell your golfing friends that we're trying to continue to have some fun guests on here just chatting golf like we did. I really enjoyed the conversation we had. So we will be back next week. I have somebody I think is going to be pretty interesting for next week. So make sure you come back and we will talk to you then.